Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, where we discuss the latest topics relating to deterrence-related issues. And of course, I am Adam Lowther, joined by Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky, our normal cohort, our round table of what I like to think of as great minds. And today
we definitely have the first team in today, don't we?
Great.
So there was an article that came out on Reuters, and it came out today, as a matter of fact. And the article title is "Putin Warns the West: Russia is Ready for Nuclear War." And Vladimir Putin sat down, gave an interview. The election, the Russian election, the presidential election is starts on Friday, and it lasts till Sunday. I think, you know, you got to make sure you round up the voters. You need time to do that to make sure they vote the right way. Now that Alexei Navalny has been dispatched, I think Vladimir Putin stands a better chance of getting reelected. It was touch and go there for a minute. But in his interview, he warned the United States and the West that Russia is, of course, ready to use nuclear weapons. And he said, you know, and he very somewhat surprisingly said that nuclear weapons are made to be used. And so he was very clear in his threat to the United States. And, you know, some people will disagree about whether that's bluster, whether he's serious. And of course, he referred to Russian nuclear doctrine and just said, hey, look at our doctrine. This is how we'll use them. And so I thought that'd be a great topic for discussion. So let me start off with you, Curtis, because I know you're chomping at the bit to discuss this latest and greatest of Vladimir Putin's threats to use nuclear weapons.
Well, thanks, Adam. Always good to see you. And Jim, always good to have your intellect on this, what we call it, a steam panel. I don't know. But hey, we're here, and this is a great topic. You know, I'm always fascinated by the way Putin blusters with his nuclear rhetoric and threats and how he uses his strategic communication. And then I'm even more fascinated by how the West receives it. And it's always interesting because we definitely don't receive it the same way every time. Many times we tend to want to just disbelieve it as, you know, just the ranting of someone who's ill prepared or is losing their war or wants to use empty threats and these sorts of things. And I think we're really at risk of hurting our strategic position when we disregard these kinds of threats. Now, I understand the arguments, Adam, that many will say, well, if we acquiesce to those threats, if we believe in the bluster, that we will therefore empower his activities even more, that he'll show him that we can be coerced and manipulated by these kinds of threats. And there might be some truth to that, but the reality is, what is your choice? If you don't listen and believe, are you going to challenge? Are you going to call them on it? And I think that the reality here is that when you have someone who, even in the latest report, the 2024 annual threat assessment just recently put out by the intelligence community, that continues to say that, quote, Russia will continue to modernize its nuclear weapons capabilities and maintains the largest and most diverse nuclear weapons stockpile, period. Not the U.S., Russia. So when they have threats, you kind of have to take that into account. I think we'd all agree. And so the one thing I think that what we have an issue with here is the Western mindset. And that is that we tend not to want to make these sort of obvious outward nuclear threats to our adversaries. We prefer our threats to be maybe a little softer and a little more nuanced. But we've got a reputation for making our own threats as well. But let me do say one more comment here before I pass it over. And that is, Putin says that that nuclear weapons are made to be used. Well, let's define used, right? And I think Putin defines used the same way we do. And that is that nuclear weapons are used every day to deter and instill peace and stability. That's our position. For the Russians, their nuclear weapons are being used every day to coerce the West from getting more involved in the Ukrainian conflict, for example, as well as, of course, deter in a traditional sense an attack by the United States, if you will, or NATO countries upon them, who they view, by the way, as a strategic threat. So the weapons being used for everyday deterrence, they're used every day. But I always like to stress that deployment is different than employment, and it is the employment that we are most worried about.
Jim, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, when Kerr started talking and in the prep, we didn't really talk about him saying anything about the way weapons are being used because he stole my line.
Oh, no.
That was, oh, yeah, you know, but that's because I've learned from the two of you. So maybe you're wearing off on me in the podcasts and in our meetings that we have and talk about this. But seriously, to me, you're right. Nuclear, to have anything, military equipment and military posturing and military dialogue, they are all to be used. Those are the tools that we use to maintain peace, because if we all get quiet and we all hide what we have, then someone's going to take a chance or someone's not going to understand the other person. So in this case here, I see Putin using his nuclear weapons to his advantage. He does that by making threats, or at least posturing those threats. Actually, it's a veiled threat. He didn't really say we're going to nuke anyone. He just simply says, if our sovereignty is infringed upon, we are prepared to use nuclear weapons. Well, I believe, I don't have the policy, or maybe Curtis or Adam can mention that, but I believe if someone attacks the United States, we are prepared to use nuclear weapons. And so therefore, nothing's really changed. So the real question here is, why is Putin doing this now? And I believe that in the onset of Adam's discussion here, we get to the nitty-gritty of what's going on. There's an election coming, and I think Putin's threatened by all those other people on the ticket that might push him off. And so, I think he's posturing because he wants to make his point. And his point is that he's in charge. And he does that very well by simply posturing with his bluster. Now, you call it bluster, and I actually replicated that. I probably shouldn't have repeated it that way. He's using his rhetoric, and he knows that the West will respond. And our news articles have responded, actually. In news, you know, I mentioned in the show prep, there's one article that Curtis pulled out. But you just do Putin nuclear weapons in your search. Use your Google, Mr. Google, as General Busey always says. Hopefully, I'll attribute that to him. Mr. Google will come out there and give you all that information. But what is most interesting is if you look, you can look at this Putin mentioning his nuclear weapons today, yesterday, last month, the month before, 2023, 2022, 20. Pick a year that Putin's had some charge. And he has mentioned his nuclear weapons as being a tool in his tool chest that he wants people to remain aware of. And he does that overtly. In the U.S., we do it more as, you know, maybe what Curtis didn't say, covertly. For those that don't look at our YouTube channel, my wife recently saw me in doldrums and wanted me to do something. So I'm putting up, this is not an endorsement, but she bought me a nuclear explosions coloring book. And so I'm holding it up here. So if you haven't gone to our YouTube channel, look at it. But what's interesting about the nuclear coloring book is that there are pictures of explosions to color. Now, some of you might think that's a little macabre. I pulled it up in front of my camera. Okay, I got to pull it behind. There you go. There's a nuclear explosion beside my microphone.
You better have a lot of red crayons to get through that picture.
I got red and yellow. Those are the only two I have. And so my point in all this, though, is that's what a nuclear explosion looks like. It looks the same if we're the one making it explode or if Putin's making it explode. They all look the same because they're explosions of nuclear weapons. And the point of deterrence is that a nuclear weapon deters a nuclear weapon. How you use it in your daily use by signaling or not signaling is your choice. I just have one other piece to mention, though, since Putin says he has the most modern nuclear weapon systems out there. And I like Curtis always pulls up numbers. So I'm going to pull up a set of numbers. The United States conducted 1,032 tests of nuclear weapons. We are sure we understand our weapons, their designs, and their outputs very, very well. Soviet Union only carried 715 of those tests. So, not quite twice, but a whole lot more. We've got a lot of information. And we're using that on a daily basis to modernize our systems with more information and more detail. And you can thank the United States for doing those tests and our will to do those. So, pass it back to you, Adam.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that Vladimir Putin is blustering. I actually think he believes that there's an asymmetry of capability that he has that we don't. And Vladimir Putin knows very well. I think he understands us better than we understand him. And he probably knows very well that the United States, let's suppose he uses a small number of nuclear weapons, you know, five or less. And they're probably lower yield of, you know, varying low yields. It could be, you know, 30 tons to, you know, single digit kilotons. He knows we're going to respond with conventional strikes, if at all. And it'll you know, depend largely on where he uses them, how he uses them, what are the effects of those strikes. And I'm not certain that you know, this is just bluster.
Adam, can I contradict you just a little bit?
Sure.
Here? I don't
sure.
think there's an asymmetry of capability. I think there's an asymmetry of will, and there's a difference, especially
both.
You think of will.
All right, Jim, now you stole it from me. I just wrote that note down, asymmetry of will. So let me say this, Adam. I think you're completely right here. There is an asymmetry. I think in valuation, right? The Russians refer to their nuclear weapons as guardian angels. The Americans tend to, you know, want to, I don't know, they're maybe slightly embarrassed by their nuclear capability. And I think we have to understand that there's a different valuation of this capability. Russians see these nukes as bigger bombs. We see these as catastrophic decisions. And again, I think you're spot on, Adam, when you say that I think that Putin understands us better than we understand him. I think that is absolutely true. And I would also put in this, we have an asymmetry of interest. That is, Putin cares a lot more about what happens with this Ukraine conflict than we probably do. And now I'm not including the Ukrainians in that decision. I'm just talking between Americans and Russians. And so those asymmetry of interests also control and dictate how that will is measured and utilized. So I would agree with you there. And I've stated before on other podcasts that the fear of low-yield weapons being used is probably the greatest fear of the administration today. And it's not the actual use of the weapons. It's the decision they have to make the next day, because I don't know that they really have figured out what to do if. But we don't have to worry about this, Adam. This is good news, because in this same interview that Putin said, he said, we're doing fine on the battlefield. There's no need for us to have to use nuclear weapons on the battlefield anyway.
Yeah.
So we should all be just fine with that and sleep well.
Curtis, don't you think, though, that the tactical weapons, though, are not the U.S. threat? They're more the NATO threat. Now, I know it, you know, it all goes back together because of our agreements and our treaties. But doesn't that play into only a role of escalation versus a threat to the sovereign United States? Is that what Adam's talking about when he says we're probably not going to respond?
No, I don't think, to be honest with you, you know, I don't see them in quite the same light. I mean, there are, you know, there's strategic use for us, and that's our strategic arsenal. And but there's no real such thing for the Russians, because any quote unquote tactical use on our part is strategic to them.
That's correct.
It could threaten, you know, the government, the regime. But yet, you know, think about what it would take for the North Atlantic Council. So let's suppose hypothetically that a nuclear weapon were to strike, you know, in Poland, for example, if, you know, the Russians wanted to strike all of this, you know, this logistics train that is feeding the Ukrainians, for example, and they, you know, they used ultra low yield weapons that just at an air burst, you know, fallout free high to burst, they sort of destroy all the logistics hub, and, you know, that sends a very clear signal. It's an attack on NATO. The Poles are going to strike immediately. The Spaniards and the Portuguese and the Icelandic and, you know,
wait a minute.
They're all going to be like, whoa, guys, whoa. You know, who knows what the Germans will do? We know where the Baltic states are going to stand. Can you get the North Atlantic Council, the NAC? Are they going to all come together and say, yeah, let's do it?
That's right.
They're probably going to respond with, okay, you can strike Russian targets in Ukraine, but not Crimea, with, you know, precision conventional weapons. That's what you'll probably get. That's what I think you'll get. And the Russians know that if they can get us to sort of make those types of decisions, then they've won.
Yes, right. They'll be escalation dominant.
You know, and that's it's actually what I think probably would happen. And for the Russians, all they're doing is grinding down the Ukrainians. And mm-hmm. and that's, you know, there's, what, 45 million Ukrainians? Millions of them fled. And so now you're putting in Ukraine, you've got guys our age that are in uniform in trenches fighting against Russians. And, you know, this is sort of not where you want to be. This is how, you know, the Germans at the end of the war in late 44 and 45, it was, you know, 13, 14 year olds and guys our age and older that were doing the fighting, you know, in France, for example. And so, you know, the Ukrainians are not in a good position. And this is something that, you know, some of our Russia colleagues from the IC have been saying, you know, that this is what the Russians do. They grind you down and eventually wear you out, even though they take lots and lots of losses. And the Russians had to fight this war now. Go ahead.
But Adam, don't you think your scenario of escalation and even, you know, the NATO countries and the NAC getting involved, you know, isn't that the same with just conventional use of weapons in Russia, even if they'd expand the war with conventional but threaten nuclear? I mean, isn't that the point? We've got to find a way to not kowtow to the threat or the insinuation of a threat of nuclear weapons. And I mean, that's the part that I don't understand, because you can have all this escalation and never fire one nuke and win because everyone's afraid to get it started. And that's the piece that I was referring to earlier.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Curtis?
That's the value of nuclear weapons, is the fear of escalation.
Yeah,
and that's why it keeps small wars small. So I would argue that. But let's take a moment and let's look at the doctrine, right? So the Russian doctrine was released back in 2020 for those who are curious, and you can find it online. There are some translations and so forth. The Russians aren't secret about it, but there's really four key conditions that make it possible that Russians will employ nuclear weapons. I thought I'd go over them very quickly. The first one is the receipt of reliable information about the launch of ballistic missiles attacking the territory of the Russian Federation and or its allies. So let's take a moment. So in this statement, it basically says a launch-on warning is likely possible, and they are at least claiming some sort of extended deterrence umbrella to their allies. The second condition is the use of an adversary's nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction on the territories of the Russian Federation or its allies. That's kind of what our American policy would be. So that makes perfect sense, at least in my mind. The third reason would be adversary actions affecting critically important state or military objects of the Russian Federation, to which the disablement of which could lead to the disruption of retaliatory actions by nuclear forces. What this means is that if you attack anything that has to do with their nuclear command and control or their nuclear weapons, they will consider that a reason to retaliate with nuclear weapons. So even if you attack all of that capability with precision conventional weapons, you will still, per their doctrine, elicit a nuclear response. In other words, you cannot conventionally fight your way out of a nuclear war.
And that's key. That's something that's
key.
Because that's exactly what the United States wants to do.
That is correct.
And they're telling us no.
They're telling us we've read your playbook, and we're not going to allow you to do that. And then finally, the fourth one here is aggression against the Russian Federation with the use of conventional weapons when the very existence of the state is in jeopardy. Now, this is a bit nebulous, and you know, this could be everything from, are you actually got a threat against the leadership themselves, or are you threatening sovereignty of this and that? And so when you take into account sovereignty, now you're saying that if the conventional war risks the border, they may decide, at least per their doctrine, to use nuclear weapons in order to protect that. Why is that important? Because there's an election this weekend that you mentioned, Adam, and here's the key thing. Elections will include voters in Crimea, and for the first time, voters in the Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, the four areas of the Ukraine that they have annexed, are voting in this election. And so what they're telling us is that they're further legitimizing their seizing of those four provinces in eastern Ukraine. So much so, they see it so real to them that they are participating in the election. So if America is hoping that Ukraine's definition of victory will happen, which I believe President Zelensky's definition of victory is the reestablishment of Ukraine's borders pre-2014, I'm not sure that's possible without a nuclear war. And that's a tough apple to bite.
No, it's absolutely true. Did you want to add to that, Jim?
No, only to say that's where doctrine has to, you know, doctrine and diplomacy have to fit in. You have to, you know, luckily, and whether we take it at face value, Putin's told us what his end game is. The question is, how do you stop it? How do you proceed the what you say is a likely or probable nuclear war between two. So there's two things here, and I'll sort of pass it back. The two things is, how do you stop it from occurring? What are the tools of the tool chest that we have to keep that from happening? And number two, I'll just put my cards on the table. I don't see a nuclear war or a use of nuclear weapons as an end-all existential, everything's off the table type of fight, unless it's, you know, everyone's going to launch everything, but a nuclear weapon used in a place, it just puts us in a new realm, which we should think about in our doctrine and strategy, and ensure that if we get there, how do we get back out of there with the least number of difficulties in maintaining national order and our national sovereignty, and probably that's in reverse order. National sovereignty first, national order second, because in the end, national sovereignty is the one. So maybe I could sort of throw that your way as a way of talking about it. Because if we've already concluded, or at least you've concluded, I'm still not necessarily sure that nuclear war is the end of this scenario. I'll have to think on it more. But I would say, if that is the inevitable truth, I'll give you that. So put that up front. Then those are the two options we have. We've got to figure out either what to do if it happens or how do we stop it from happening.
Yeah, I would.
Thoughts?
I wouldn't say that. I'd agree with you that it, the use of a one or a small number of nuclear weapons does not inherently require escalation to, you know, Armageddon. You can use small numbers. You know, we know that you and I, the three of us, know weapons effects very well, and it doesn't in the world. You know, we've had, 2,500-ish total nuclear detonations on the face of the Earth or below the surface of the Earth. So
that's about right.
We can survive nuclear detonations. We've had a lot of them, and you don't inherently escalate. I guess my concern is that Vladimir Putin has built the kind of arsenal and he's designed the kind of doctrine that makes the United States lack the kind of credibility to ensure that an ever expanding NATO, right? We just added two more NATO members. That's a big group to hang together, right? The bigger the group, the harder it is to keep them together. And there are some in NATO who are saying we got to give Ukraine NATO membership, and the French are discussing sending NATO troops, and there's evidence that there's already Polish troops in Ukraine fighting, and the Russians, I think, have said that they've killed Polish troops, which very well could be true because the Poles hate the Russians, and so therefore, I wouldn't doubt that actually has happened. So we're in a difficult position. Vladimir Putin, if nobody's read it, there was a book that came out maybe 2 years ago called Putin. I'd recommend reading it. It follows Putin and it's very detailed. It's an excellent book. And then I'd also recommend there's another book that is a newer book. It's called Collapse, The Fall of the Soviet Union. And I'm audiobooking it and it's about 30 hours. So it's a long book. So, you know, and it goes through all of these discussions and the fears, and we're seeing, you know, it's 30 years later and all of the fears that Vladimir Putin and Gorbachev and the senior Russian leadership at that time, those fears are now realized for them. They're saying, yes, we were right. What we feared in 87, 88, 89, what we thought the Americans would do, they've lied to us repeatedly. They're now doing it. And for them, their sort of conspiracy mind is being vindicated. And for them, the use of nuclear weapons is just, it's like, hey, man, we've got to do it. This is how we push the Americans back. Because the Americans keep creeping. I mean, look at them now. They're on our borders. They're literally, you know, less than a day's march from St. Petersburg, our second city. And if they are able to, you know, turn Ukraine into a NATO member, they'll be in our great southern city. They'll be there within hours. And, you know, all we've got right now is Belarus to protect, you know, give us a little bit of room for Moscow to fall back. So all of their fears and, you know, that conspiratorial mind that is Russia is being proven true. And I really think, you know, we sort of need to think through this and think through the promises we've made. And I'm not a Russia apologist. I don't care for the Russians any more than anybody else does. But, you know, it's we have to be well thought out. You know, there's good reasons on both sides for what we do. You know, it's hard to not be empathetic with Ukrainians wanting to live free and look west and not east. I'd want to look west if I were them. I wouldn't want to look to Moscow. It's hard to not be empathetic. But, man, you know, Vladimir Putin, I think you have to take him more seriously than people do, because in his mind, everything he's been saying for 30 years is now being proven right.
Yeah, let me build on that for just a second, Adam. It's fascinating what you just said, and I would push back a little bit on the issue of Sweden and Finland. You know, they've given up 70 plus years of neutrality. This wasn't an easy decision for them, but this was a decision forced upon them by Putin, by his actions. My sense is that Finland and Sweden would have been perfectly comfortable with the status quo prior to 2022, but that fear created or that action, that behavior of Putin created a fear that they needed the lawful guarantee, for lack of a better description, of the Article 5. And now what that has created, to your point, Adam, is a new 800-some-odd-mile border, NATO border, directly with Russia, right? The border of Finland. And so going back to a comment we had earlier in the podcast, you know, utilizing NATO tactical weapons on Russian territory in a Russian mindset is a strategic attack, right? Because it's occurring on their soil. And so that changes the calculus about how you would engage with them. So in this case, I really feel bad for the Belarusians, because that's where the exchanges, you know, could likely occur. But with regard to Ukraine, a couple benefits here for Putin keeping them in conflict. You cannot join NATO if you're in a conflict, in an active conflict. So this prevents Ukraine from even being discussed about a NATO membership. And I would argue that discussions of NATO membership and EU membership and things like that is sort of a drove Putin's actions.
They are.
You know, in the standard, right, Thucydides fear, honor, interest calculus. This is just something that cannot happen in their minds, right? They concoct this this brotherhood argument of this diaspora and this long relationship between the Ukrainians and the Russians and I got it. And I understand, you know, a little bit of that history and I understand the meaning. My question from a Western perspective is, what value does Ukraine bring to NATO other than trouble, right? Because it's pissing off the adversary that you're trying to provide some sort of stability and peace against, or with, or however you want to define that. So I'm not sure that poking the bear, literally and metaphorically, by admitting the Ukraine into NATO is necessarily the right thing to do. Some sort of Finlandization should be the answer here with regard to the Ukraine. But before we can ever get there, we must end this war. And this war cannot, if it continues, you really do. You know, every day the war continues is another day of a potential nuclear, right, a detonation, if somebody were to decide that they were going to go there. If you had Ukrainian troops running, you know, along the Crimean border, what would that drive in response? And I just think that those are issues that are difficult to negotiate. And so really what it comes down to is do you begin the negotiation from a position of strength where Ukraine has to make some hard decisions about not getting back the already captured Russian territory, Ukrainian territory, I should say, that the Russians have captured and annexed and are now voting, or do you fight to the bitter end in the hopes that Putin, with this largest, most diverse nuclear stockpile and a doctrine to enforce it, is actually going to acquiesce and say, all right, after 300,000+ Russian casualties, we're going to go ahead and just let you have it back. I just don't see it happening. And so I think that we're all sort of lying to ourselves in this. We here in the West think that somehow this war is going to end with Ukraine intact, and Russia and Putin somehow thinks that he's going to wait out the West and all of its wealth and capability. And who's going to pay the price in the end? It's the Ukrainian people. Generations of Ukrainian men are being lost. If there's 300,000 casualties on the Russian side, there are 300,000 casualties on the Ukrainian side. All depends on how you're counting. And billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars being spent on this war, almost $500 billion in infrastructure destruction, And who's going to be asked to rebuild the Ukraine when it's all over with if they win? Will Putin pay reparations and rebuild the Ukraine? I doubt it. It will be the Western taxpayer who will foot this bill. So we will pay to fight the war, and then we will pay to rebuild afterwards. And then what? And I just think that, again, you know, as you all know, we are $35 trillion in debt. We are borrowing $1 trillion every 100 days. And we're looking at giving Ukraine the equivalent of the United States Marine Corps budget. And once we give that one back to them, when will the next ask come? Because Russia's not going to stop. And so I think we need to be motivated. And I think the American election here this November, it may be the point at which something can change one way or the other, no matter who wins. That will be an inflection point on whether or not this is going to drive on or if it's finally going to come to an end.
Well, another great discussion on a prescient topic. You know, that's sort of the good thing, perhaps, if you can call it a good thing today, is that, you know, there's always something to talk about when it comes to deterrence and, you know, nuclear weapons in particular. So we'll look forward to next week's discussion. We haven't picked out what it is, right? Because we talk about the most current topics. So we'll see what that might be come next Wednesday. So, of course, thanks to Curtis and Jim for joining us this week. And thanks to you, the listeners, who join us again. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.